You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new season of PBS Wisconsin series Wisconsin Life debuts this week. We'll get a preview from the host and producer of the show. Now, in an unprecedented move, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources passed a quota for this year's wolf hunt that was different, lower, than the one already approved by the State Natural Resources Board. The DNR's quota of 130 is less than half of what the Natural Resources Board passed. The DNR's decision to go against the Resource Board's recommendation underscores tensions between the agencies and the controversial nature of the wolf hunt here in the state. We're talking about this year's wolf hunt, or hunts, really, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on these dueling guidelines for a wolf quota for the fall hunt? Should there be a fall hunt for wolves at all in the state? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Paul Smith is the outdoors editor from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Great to be with you.
Well, before we get into some of the politics and the dispute here, can you tell us what the Natural Resources Board had approved versus what the DNR itself now has said?
Yes, the Natural Resources Board at its August 11 meeting voted for a wolf quota of 300 animals. It was quite a contentious meeting because the DNR had recommended a quota of 130. And there was debate about where to put this number. One board member put a number out there as high as 500. And this caused quite a bit of contentiousness between the department and some of the board members, because the DNR was trying to manage this fall's hunt to a goal of no substantial change in the wolf population. That in itself is an interesting thing to consider, because there is no current wolf population estimate in the state. But if 300 or 500 wolves were taken, in either case, it would reduce the population. And the department was trying to hold things more stable, in part because the state is undergoing a process to develop a new wolf management plan. But at that August meeting, the NRB eventually voted 5-2 on this quota of 300 wolves. It did not please Preston Cole, the DNR secretary, and it spilled over into September when the DNR made it clear they weren't going to send any staff to the planned board meeting that month, and NRB chairman Fred Prane ended up canceling that meeting. Wolf hunters and trappers who had applied were waiting. They were expecting to get notified if they were successful in a permit drawing by mid-September. That didn't happen. The DNR didn't hold on until Monday. So October 4th, the department announced that it was going to set the wolf quota at 130 animals, which it had recommended a month ago. So it's opened up a whole new debate about authority between the DNR and the Natural Resources Board.
Now, one piece of context here. I mean, we could go back years and years with the back and forth over the listing of the gray wolf as an endangered species, but it's delisted here in Wisconsin. And we had this hunt earlier this year. So the fall hunt would technically be the second hunt of, or not technically, it would be the second out of 2021. What came out of that first hunt that led DNR staff to want a lower target, or maybe even no hunt at all? I've heard the argument.
Yeah. Well, the DNR had wanted to hold a single hunt this year. The wolf was delisted in early January. So that returned, after 6 years, it returned management authority of this species to the state. And that's significant, because what that allows is lethal control, and that includes hunting and trapping. It also includes removal of wolves around farms and ranches if they're causing depredations. So the DNR made its plan clear in January that it wanted to hold a single hunt, and that would have been this fall. That's required by state statute. Wisconsin is unique in many regards when it comes to wolves, and one of them is that no other state has a statute that requires the DNR to hold a wolf hunt when the species is off the endangered or threatened species list. So the DNR was compelled by law to do it. They wanted to wait until November, and they were taken to court, and the ruled that the DNR needed to hold it before the season ended. That statute also spells out the season dates. So it has to start in early November and end at the end of February. And so there was some time, and the DNR held a rush season in February. It resulted in a kill of 218 wolves by state licensed hunters and trappers. That was 83% higher than the state licensed quota. The DNR had attempted to hold their portion of the hunt. They wanted to keep the kill to 119 animals. So that was what the quota was for state licensed hunters and trappers. They blew past that, killed 218. And that didn't make, nobody was really happy about that. What it's caused, nobody is a strong word. So mm-hmm. There are people in the state who would prefer to see a much lower wolf population and even no wolves at all. But so that's our background. That has led to some additional lawsuits. So the DNR now is being sued by Ojibwa tribes who want to see the wolf hunt stop this fall, and some wildlife advocacy groups who are also suing the DNR. They want to see the wolf hunt stop this fall, and they're also challenging that state statute that requires the wolf hunt. So there were a lot of wolves taken in February. The population going into the season was 1,100 roughly. And so those 218 wolves were taken out of that population. And that hunt occurred, part of the controversy is that hunt occurred during the wolf breeding season. And Wisconsin, we had three wolf hunts from 2012 to 2014. And those all happened in the late fall, early winter, not during the wolf breeding season. So there was a lot of uncertainty, and the DNR could not complete a wolf population estimate after the hunt. So no one really knows how many wolves are in the state right now. And that all caused the DNR to want to take a very conservative approach to this fall hunt and put a lower quota out there. So this dispute between the Natural Resources Board and the DNR goes back that many months.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Good afternoon, folks. Hopefully I don't alienate anybody, but I'm going to go with the term the Native Americans. I know you said something about the Ojibwe. Are they at least a little bit more on board with the lower numbers? Because I understand through what I've read and heard that they consider the wolf a spirit animal. And I guess, you know, we got to keep everybody happy. So,
Pat, I got you, Pat. Paul, you mentioned an Ojibwe tribal lawsuit over the wolf hunt. Have we seen responses from them about this lower target from the DNR?
I have not seen any response from the Ojibwe tribes, but they place an extremely high value on wolves. They're both the spiritual value of wolves and the ecological value. And they are continuing with their lawsuit, and they have filed for a preliminary injunction. A hearing is going to be held in late October. So a federal judge is going to hear that, and the tribes hope to stop the hunt. So that's clear. Would they prefer to see fewer wolves killed than more? I think I don't want to speak for them, but that would follow their reasoning. I think they would actually prefer to have no wolf hunt at all.
Thanks for the call, Pat. We're talking to Paul Smith, outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at a controversy surrounding the fall wolf hunt in Wisconsin. The state Natural Resources Board gave a quoted number. The state DNR says lower number. We're going to find out who prevails, who wins in that scenario, or who might. Call 800-642-1234 if you have thoughts. Do you want to see a lower quota for a wolf hunt this fall? Do you want to see a hunt at all? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We pick up our talk now with Paul Smith, outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking to, at controversy surrounding the fall wolf hunt in Wisconsin. Before we go back to our callers, Paul, at 800-642-1234, we're in uncharted territory here, right? If the Natural Resources Board says a number and the DNR says a different number, which number ends up winning?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Uncharted territory. It's unprecedented. I've been covering the board since 1994, and there traditionally had been a collegial relationship between the board members and the DNR. And for your listeners, the Natural Resources Board is a 7-member citizen board. They're appointed by governors, they serve staggered 6-year terms, and they're confirmed by the Senate. And these are typically people who have strong interest in conservation and natural resources issues, and have always responded quite readily to science presented to them by DNR experts. And this current board has several members who have defied the DNR science on deer and wolf issues. So this really cropped up this year in setting this wolf quota. And never before has a DNR gone against and tried to set a quota after the Natural Resources Board had voted on one. The Natural Resources Board is created in state statute to oversee the DNR. So it's going to be very interesting how this plays out. The DNR obviously didn't just do this on a whim. So I asked for and received text from the DNR that supported their position. And so they have in the wolf hunting statute in state law, it does say the DNR can set the quota and also the seasons, and that there's an administrative code thing too, that's a DNR sort of rule that has language about this. So it's probably going to have to play out in a legal arena to see who's going to win this. But this is the most serious challenge I've ever seen to the authority of the Natural Resources Board.
Let's go back to our callers now. Russ is with us in McFarland. Russ, hi.
Hi there. Nice to hear you.
What did you want to bring up, Russ?
Well, I think it's terrible that we have such an anti-science bent on some of the members of the committee. So I think 130 is a conservative figure, if that's what the DNR thinks is appropriate. And I really think there's still a lot of people who have a bias against wolves. They are part of the ecology. They do help manage the deer population. And also, I really object to the fact that we have a situation where we allow really unethical hunting of the wolves. You allow them to be chased by dogs, and then if that dog gets attacked and killed by a wolf, then me as a taxpayer has to pay for the replacement of that dog. It's just a whole messed up situation.
Russ, thanks for the call. That last point, I know there's depredation payments if people lose livestock. Is there a payment in that case that our caller mentioned of a hunting dog lost in the line of hunting?
There is, but not in the case of wolf hunting. So if someone's using dogs to hunt wolves and one of those dogs gets injured or killed by a wolf, they are not eligible for compensation for that. What happens much more often in Wisconsin is people who are running hounds during the bear training season or the bear hunting season. And so if you're using your dogs for So for bear hunting or for another type of hunting other than wolf hunting, yes, then you can get compensation, and that's usually $2,500 per dog.
Thanks for the call, Russ. Russ also brought up another key point in the debate, the wolf impact on the deer population. Controlling it in a good way, supporters of the gray wolf say. Hunters worry that they over-control it, meaning there are fewer deer to hunt.
Yeah, that's a traditional debate, and many hunters see wolf as an enemy because they're both going after the same prey. Wolves are extremely valuable to help bring a healthy balance into the ecosystem. And I'm a lifelong Wisconsin hunter, and I've hunted all over the state. Most of our state is overpopulated with deer, Rob. That's a fact. And wolves can be very helpful to address that situation. There are certain areas, no doubt, where the deer are lower in number, and you can argue that some measures to help increase deer numbers there would help. But studies have shown that wolves are not a leading cause of deer mortality in the state. It's really in the north. It's winter weather, and it's human hunters, which are take most of the deer.
Thanks again for the call. We are talking to Paul Smith from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, outdoors editor there, about another wolf hunt this year in Wisconsin and different targets set for the number of wolves taken by the Natural Resources Board, a lower number from the state DNR. Back to your calls now. We've got Roxanne with us in Reedsburg. Roxanne, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Roxanne?
I was just curious, because I'm new to the area again, do we have any treaties regarding this? Are we breaking any treaties?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Roxanne. There are treaty rights held by the Ojibwa tribes in the state, and that's in what's called the ceded territory. That's ceded land from treaties in the 1800s. It's roughly the northern third of Wisconsin. In that area, the tribes have off-reservation rights to hunt and gather. So when a wolf season like this is considered, the tribes are entitled to 50% of the quota. When it comes to wolves, the tribes use their quota to protect the animals rather than kill them, which they're entitled to do. So, for instance, for this season, the DNR has just this week, when they set that 130 quota, it gave a portion of those wolves to the tribes, and it would result in 74 being left over for state licensed hunters and trappers. So, but yes, to answer your question, there are treaties that affect things like this wolf season.
Thanks a lot for the call, Roxanne. We'll go to Brian now in Onalaska. Brian, hi.
Hi. One of the things that I find just a little frustrated about this conversation is that it seems like it constantly goes back to, how do we keep all the people happy? How do we keep many different groups of people happy? And I guess my personal belief on it is that that's an animal that, in the first place, probably shouldn't ever be taken off of the endangered species list, just based on the loss of habitat. And what we've seen has occurred in places like Yellowstone, when the gray wolf has been reintroduced to those places, and the effects of trophic cascading and things like that. And just would be curious to hear your thoughts on what this animal truly needs in terms of habitat and range to be considered for something like a hunt.
Brian, thanks for the call. And Paul, Brian hits on really kind of the core of this. Should the gray wolf be delisted? There's been a back and forth going on for years and years now.
Yeah, and it's a question that's before a judge right now. There's a federal lawsuit against the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It seeks to restore those Endangered Species Act protections to the wolf. I don't expect that case to be decided anytime soon, but Wisconsin is different from Yellowstone area in that we have a higher human population and a higher density of development in Wisconsin across our wolf range. And what that means is there's a higher chance, and we have higher incidence of conflicts with ranchers, farmers. And so it would be nice to think about no lethal controls of wolves and just let them live in Wisconsin. But I think as a practical matter, there's always going to be some conflicts, and we're going to have some sort of a way to resolve those conflicts. It's a very difficult and challenging question.
Thanks for that call. Paul, just in our last minute or so, what are you watching for next on this?
I'm watching the federal court case by the Ojibwas. Their motion for a preliminary injunction, which would stop the wolf hunt, is being held later in October, and that's in Madison at a federal court. And that judge will be hearing the arguments and will make a decision. And that's something to watch for this. As far as the dispute between the Natural Resources Board and the DNR, I have no idea how that's going to play out. But I'm sure they're talking to each other either through internal attorneys or emails, but that could also be resolved, or we'll hear something in days about that.
Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Paul Smith, outdoors editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked to us about the fall wolf hunt and dueling numbers. The Natural Resources Board wanted one quota for wolves. The DNR came out with a lower quota. Not clear how that gets resolved. Coming up, from a trip down a ski slope to a mysterious musical instrument, we'll get a sneak preview of Wisconsin Life, a new season on public television. Remember, you can follow all these conversations online at WPR.org. Stream the Ideas Network live or go back and check out older conversations that you missed. Or share them with your friends if they missed them. Or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app to stream live or check out the archives there as well. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, is buying a 55-gallon drum of mayonnaise a good idea? Could be. We'll look at the pros and cons of shopping at warehouse clubs, whether they can save you money in the long run, and who stands to benefit the most from them. Now, a lot of things are coming back this fall. Another highly anticipated return, the Wisconsin Life TV series on PBS Wisconsin. Host Angela Fitzgerald travels all over the Badger State, exploring places she's never been before and highlighting interesting Wisconsinites and their passions. The 8th season of the series kicks off tomorrow night, and to learn a little more about what we can expect and how the team overcame some pandemic-related challenges to produce the show, we caught up with Angela Fitzgerald and the series producer, Kelly Saran. Angela, can you give us a taste of some of the places you made it in putting together this season of Wisconsin Life?
Sure. Well, as we all know, COVID has impacted our lives in a number of different ways. And so shooting for this season has been no exception to that. And so we were had to be pretty creative in terms of shoots for this season to accommodate the pandemic conditions. So we did a lot of shoots outside just because that felt safer. Of course, once conditions were safe to shoot at all. And so our very first shoot was at Granite Peak Ski Hill. That was the only shoot that we were able to do pre-COVID. So you'll see more of the normal interactions that we were accustomed to having, not having masks, all that sort of thing, where I was able to go skiing, which was the first ski experience I have had in years. It was a little bit scary, but it was fun to be back out there and skiing and experiencing a location in Wisconsin that I had not yet before. And so following that shoot, everything else had to, again, have COVID accommodations in place. And so we went to a couple of different state parks, Yellowstone Lake State Park, Governor Dodge State Park. We did some interesting things at Yellowstone Lake State Park in terms of recognizing the accommodations needed for people who might have access challenges. And so uplifting Accessibility Wisconsin, which is an awesome nonprofit that provides at no cost to individuals wheelchairs that allow them to actually experience trails and hiking. So we had a great time this season. Again, a lot of flexibility and shifting things around, but I'm super proud of what the team and I were able to execute, and hopefully viewers are able to enjoy.
Well, let's get some taste of the final product. Kelly, can you set up our first clip here on Miss Black USA?
Yeah, so this piece is actually about Takiema Ballantyne, and she won Miss Black USA in 2019. And we kind of follow her as she tries to work to uplift her her experiences and her voice to help others, especially around children. So this is a clip from this piece of Takiema.
I think it means a lot to young girls in Wisconsin to see a brown person in a crown, but also who has determination and goals.
Good morning.
For girls to see that I'm in nursing school. That's a profession that's all about caring for another person, well-being of the community, your society. Because we have to lean on each other. Like, nobody lives in the society alone.
I gotta say, Angela, I'm a little envious in many ways, not in the sense that I didn't, you know, break any legs while skiing or anything, which I probably would have, but I'm envious. I get to meet cool people, but I do it all from the studio. What is it like getting out and meeting people in the midst of their story and the places they work, or seeing the cool places themselves?
I really appreciate it, which feels surprising for me to say, because I do feel like I'm a naturally introverted person. But being able to connect with people in settings that they truly enjoy and they have a passion about, and that they're able to share with the rest of us about, I think is great. And that comes through when we're having these conversations. And for a lot of them, it's very natural and organic because of how strongly they feel about the settings in which they're speaking of. So it just has a flow to it. So it makes it easier for me. It makes it easy for them. And hopefully others are hearing about something that they can then connect to at some later point in time.
And Kelly, can you talk about how you go seeking out these stories, these interesting people and places and events around the state?
Yeah, so we work with a group of producers who kind of travel around the state. We keep our eye on local papers. We kind of keep an eye on the buzz in communities to try to find individuals that kind of have a special story to tell. And everybody always asks me, like, do you run out of stories to tell in Wisconsin? And it amazes me. We don't. Like, there are people that we find all over the place, like, doing interesting, really creative things, like, really passionate about it. There's a piece we feature this season is a woman in Madison who has glued rubber ducks onto her car just to bring a smile to people's face. There's a project working with incarcerated people to bring their art and display it. So it's amazing that we can continue to find people. And we send our producers out. They spend quality time with people, and we come back and we try to share their stories to the best of our ability.
Well, here's one, Kelly, that you discovered that I love. I'm a musician, and I am obsessed with the instrument, the theremin. I've never played one myself. It's that eerie motion picture sound. You've got a clip for us from the series on a Wisconsin theremin repair person?
Yeah, and he actually builds theremins. Okay. His name is Charles Collins. Yep, and it's like one of those things that, wow, you can make a life, you know, doing this is pretty incredible. And I picked this piece just to kind of entice people. Like, you can hear the sound, but I really want you to watch the show to see how he plays it, because it's quite unique.
I started fixing musical instruments, amplifiers, and stereo equipment 35 years ago for a local store. That had to go somewhere. My name's Charles Collins, and I build theremins. The theremin is a musical instrument that you can play without touching it. You don't find the theremin finds you.
Angela, I had no idea this was going on here in Wisconsin. How cool is it to just get to be in the middle of these stories that probably people didn't even know, maybe even about their own neighbor?
Exactly. And that's some of the feedback that we've gotten from the show, is that there are people who have been born and raised in Wisconsin. Their families are from Wisconsin. And there are things that we're sharing that they're learning for the first time. So I was assuming that, being a new Wisconsiner myself, relatively, that these are things that, oh, others know about, but we're all learning some of these things together for the very first time.
Kelly, Angela mentioned earlier the changes that had to happen because of COVID, the extra precautions, it maybe skewed things in, you know, more outside type directions. How do you feel at this achievement? It's got to always be a big deal when a new season comes together. I imagine more so after this last year.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, we had to keep the distance. We had to shoot mostly everything outside. There's a few pieces that were pre-COVID, as we talked about earlier. But it was just nice for us when our production actually opened up at the station and we got to meet people again. We had to stay 6 feet apart and change a little bit how we did things. But it was just incredible to speak to people. They're people who work didn't stop. We highlight some of that in this piece. There's a farmer who really wanted to uplift people's spirits. So he's planted something like 2 million sunflowers in a cornfield just to make people smile during the pandemic. So there are people doing that work. And it was just amazing for us when we were able to get out and actually meet them. And their lives continue just like ours. And we try to tell that this season as well.
That was Kelly Saran, series producer for Wisconsin Life, and host Angela Fitzgerald. We talked to them earlier this week about the 8th season of Wisconsin Life, the TV series, which kicks off tomorrow night at 7. Right now it's time for WPR's version of Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about community.
Where we live and the relationships we nurture have a big impact on our lives. Writer R.S. Eliot Esparza shares a poem about the adventures and connections made in your neighborhood.
Las Chicas y Chicos de Blossom Street by Araceli Esparza. Door propped open with tree sticks, hanging out on Blossom Street with one step stoops. Welcome to my street. I'm Luz, Luz Maria if you're formal. Our days are filled with family news, pretending and playing, and tiny jumps. The day goes by and we dash from one playtime to the next. Chicas y chicos are girl kids and boy kids and everyone in between. This is us. We're like little picture moments at sunset. I live with my grandma, mi little sister Anna, a blind duck, and my tío. I like to hydrogarden and I'm big on organic compost. They call me mija. Izzy, my best friend, is learning to do perfect cartwheels. And like the sunshine, she almost pokes my eye. Next door, stuck in their room with Wi-Fi, clicking a keyboard and swishing a finger pad, Junior doesn't fix mufles, he fixes code, night until day. Upstairs lives the twins, Paco y Pedro. Free time is dress-up time, and that's when Pedro wears pink. He banana smiles and drinks atole. Paco prefers green tacos and ham. When she wants to be like every boy neighbor, Anna plays the ultimate games and double dares us to race. She wins most of the time. With his empty cupboards, half-filled plates, our neighbor, Luis, comes over for grandma's tacos de jamón y pan. But on Sundays, he puts ketchup on his tamale. Best dressed with shiny white shoes and tapping toes, Beta has two puppies who swing her over puddles and carry her to pick the blooming lilacs across the street. Con los vecinos, our neighbors, we learn to ride our bikes in the parking lot. Together we have a cookout and be like family. None of us are related. Still, we talk, argue, and laugh like familia. Okay, let's race, Beta says. And her dress flutters against the wind. Anna, with holy toe shoes, makes up for time jumping over onion beds, while Mago speeds up and stops short at the corner. Her arms are ready for the Olympics. No one told her she couldn't walk. They told her she could fly. My friend Izzy gets stuck on Saturday morning meetings at the local Centro Comunitario, a stand-up-for-your-rights mommy equals tag-along girl kid. When she comes home, Izzy skips upstairs, finds her friends to compare drawings on tablets. The twins' place is always busy with parties, viernes de quinceañera, sábados de cumpleaños, y domingos de virgencita. Paco y Pedro wonder when all the cheek pinching will ever end. Four cheeks aren't enough. In the next building over, Juan, his three brothers and one sister, sleep tight as pea pods in one room they call theirs. In their dreams, they can be anyone. He asks me, when will the beans come up? Soon, very soon, I show him. Through the city's dusty roads, fresh air smells break through. Against the orange sunset, I step off my Dios troca and I am home. I smile at my garden. For me, all of them are my friends. We have aventuras, vidas, y laughter. Somos los de Blossom Street. We are from Blossom Street.
That was writer Araceli Esparza. PBS Wisconsin has created animation for her poem, Las Chicas y Chicos de Blossom Street. Head over to wisconsinlife.org to see it come to life. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll find out who can and can't benefit from shopping at big warehouse stores. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. For consumers, the appeal of shopping at big warehouse stores like the Costco's and Sam's Clubs of the world is that you can buy stuff in bulk and hopefully save a few bucks in the process. For some people, it pans out that way. If you like your ketchup and go through it fast, it might make financial sense to get the big bottle that lasts longer than a bunch of little ones. What if you can't afford the supersized bottle, let alone the membership fee? Then you wind up spending more on ketchup in the long run. Nancy Wong is a professor of consumer science at UW-Madison. She joins us now to look at the economics of big warehouse stores and why it's sometimes more expensive to be poor. Nancy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about that second point first. Sometimes there's a little irony here that people who have less money can't afford to buy stuff in bulk that would save them money. Can you talk about how that plays off and it plays out, especially in these big warehouse stores?
Well, I think first of all, very much depends on whether you have, I think, the ability to buy in bulk, meaning that you have, I think, the money to spend as well for the warehouse memberships, as well as having the storage space to accommodate, you know, a big enough freezers for those purchases in bulk.
You were quoted in a Marketplace article saying you used to shop at Costco, but stopped because the math didn't work out right for you. What happened?
Well, you know, I guess when you are in a small household, when it was just my husband and myself, when you buy, I think, 20 pieces of steak, unless you pretty soon run out of freezer space. And some of the perishable items, you realize that you can only make a small dent in that volume before you have to throw everything out because you're past the expiration date.
So how, for a consumer, how should they calculate, how should they try to figure out whether buying at a warehouse style store is right for them and if they're actually saving money by doing it?
Well, I think one of the first thing that you should do is to actually look at the unit pricing of, I think, the amount of, I guess, of the purchase items, because sometimes big volume is not necessarily cheaper. Oftentimes, there could be times when it is actually more expensive to buy a bigger container of, let's say, a laundry detergent, or perhaps that bottle of ketchup. So I guess some states actually have unit pricing rules so that the grocery stores are required to actually have that unit pricing to allow shoppers to be able to make that value comparison. But it is not necessarily followed and mandated in all states.
Who do you see these warehouse clubs being marketed to in particular? What is their target audience?
Well, apparently it is supposed to be an Asian American household with children making over $125,000 in annual income a year. According to Business Insider,
that's the model customer, the modal customer, I guess. Why is it? You'd think, oh, people are looking to save money, but it's maybe higher income than we might think. It sounds like
it certainly is, because first of all, I think you're not likely to be able to meet all your grocery needs by shopping in a warehouse stores, because they only carry certain items in bulk. And oftentimes you end up purchasing, especially food items, because, you know, you need to have significant storage space in a freezer or big refrigerators, and having the car to be able, you know, the transportation to actually carry these things in bulk and to store them until you could actually consume them. But then, you know, if they are non-perishable items like toilet paper and other things, you might be able to buy them in bulk since you can actually just sort of like use them as time goes by. So one need to consider what is it that they are buying and how long it takes them to actually consume them. And also do unit price comparison to make sure that you are really getting a saving out of it.
Talking to Nancy Wong, professor of consumer science at UW-Madison, looking at the economics of the way we shop, when and whether big warehouse stores make sense to do our purchases. All right, Nancy, I'm a person who loves a good bargain on the one hand. On the other hand, I don't want to do a whole lot of research before I buy ketchup. Like, are there good rules of thumbs to figure out what I should buy where?
Well, actually, I think non-perishables, I think... Warehouse clubs are a good place to buy them. And if you have the storage space for it, I think they are generally, I think, a good bargain. But at the same time, you also need to factor in the membership price that you pay. So if you're not buying a lot of stuff from these warehouse stores, you may not be able to make up for, I think, what you have to pay for your membership fee.
Now, getting back to the low-income consumers who maybe can't afford that membership fee, can't buy things in bulk from time to time, are there proven methods to help them stretch their shopping dollars?
I think so. I guess there are some stores that are known for, I think, value pricing. I can't say that I would want to advocate for any stores in particular.
Sure.
But I think there are certain stores such as Trader Joe's, for example, I guess, you know, there are certain items that they are known for that actually offer you really good value without requiring you to have to pay for membership fee, such as wine and such as certain kind of, I think, grains and various kind of, I think, dips perhaps or cheeses and, you know, certain bread. So I think there are good places where people can get good value for their money.
And we hear sometimes about places with food deserts, few or even no locally available grocery stores, for example, especially in low-income neighborhoods and cities and in some rural areas. Is that something that worries you, that some places have an abundance of choices to save money, hopefully by comparison shopping, other places have little or no option?
Yes, that I think it is a serious concern for many, I think, residents of food deserts, especially not only that they have a lack of choices, for even the same items, oftentimes they actually cost more because when you have to buy small quantities in bodegas and various other smaller stores that actually cannot take advantage of the economies of scale from, you know, inventory maintenance and stocking standpoint. So this is the ironic part, that if you live in a food desert, you end up paying more for the same items.
Just in our last minute or so, Nancy, do you see a trend? Are these warehouse stores getting bigger and spreading more, or have we kind of reached peak warehouse, do you think?
I think this is a very good question. I think there are places when probably there are still opportunities for these warehouse shops to come in. But I think there is also this growing movement of buying local that actually speaks to perhaps they are an emergence of, I think, farmers market and the smaller sort of producers that actually are perhaps even... perhaps are buying into these community stores and that actually put probably, you know, exert a different sort of, I think, incentives for people to shop in these stores and buying local. I think, especially in the current situations of the supply chain difficulties, I think buying local seems to be a sounder strategy than ever before.
Interesting. Nancy, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
You too. That's Nancy Wong, professor of consumer science at UW-Madison. We talked to her about some of the pros and cons and the economics of math of shopping at warehouse clubs versus grocery stores, for example. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, a changing climate will create an uncertain future for people all over the world. But there may be lessons in adaptation from human history and human prehistory. Find out more with the authors of the new book, Climate Chaos: Lessons on Survival from Our Ancestors. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a Facebook whistleblower testified before Congress yesterday, revealing a lot of bipartisan consensus on the idea of regulating social media companies. We'll talk about what came out yesterday, what regulation could look like, and other topics in our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.